Okay, what have we done so far? We've really looked at several parts of, well, the sentence, basically. Or at least several parts of elements that make up other parts higher up in the hierarchy, and ultimately we've stopped at the sentence. We've looked at different phones, phonemes, or different phones realizing, for example, the same phoneme. We've looked at different phonemes making up morphemes, that make up words, that make up phrases, clauses, that form sentences. Mm-hmm. Now today we're going to go beyond the sentence. We're going to look at ways of hanging, or of combining sentences, or of how elements inside the sentence are ordered because they are actually part of a whole sequence of sentences. So, in other words, we're going to look at texts, we're going to look at what makes a text, what defines a text, or what the properties of a text are, and we're going to look at how individual sentences might be different from what you expect because they are part of a text. And I've already mentioned an important word, text, and I think if I asked you, I mean, perhaps if you've done the reading, that may be more easy to answer. Much easier to answer. But if I asked you what a text was, then I think you would find this, on the one hand, very easy. Everyone has an idea about what a text is. If you went out and interviewed people to give you a definition of text, then I think everyone would first think, yeah, it's actually quite an easy question. But then, when they start thinking about it, it's perhaps as difficult as answering the question, what is a word? Remember when we asked that question, we found that there are different ways of counting words. Okay. And here too, what exactly is a text is perhaps not as straightforward as you might at first think. A lot of people will think that a text is the same or is a synonym or is another word for a literary document. Okay. So something like, I don't know, Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, or whatever. That's a text. It's a literary text. And they would be right. It's perhaps a bit less likely that people would consider this as the prototypical text when you say, well, chapter 3 in Finnegan. But of course it's a self-contained unit. It's something that isn't all that different from a literary text in many ways. It's very different in other ways. But linguistically, there are many common traits, common features. Let's look at some less likely texts. Is a bus ticket a text? It consists of words, and in fact, we can easily see, well, we can make a story, we can read a story into this, right? I mean, that person went from A to B, and we could imagine all sorts of things happening in B, etc., and then the person came back, okay, if it's a return ticket. Okay. So in that sense, it's a unit as well, and it tells a story. Is a shopping list a text? In this context, I usually tell students that when my wife, it's not when I do it, but when my wife puts together the shopping list, she puts it together in such a way that it's actually according to where things are in the shop. Okay. I can't do that. But she can do that. In that sense, you could even read some kind of story into a shopping list, which is linked to the geography of the supermarket. Many of you will perhaps have heard of Beowulf, an old English heroic poem. Several thousand lines long, and it's a text which has been around in writing for a very long time. But people believe that for many generations, it might actually have been transmitted from generation to generation purely orally. And there will no doubt have been some changes in how it was transmitted. So the text was not always the same in some way. Basic message will have been the same, the basic content, but there will have been changes. Does that mean it was a text from the beginning, or has it only become, or did it only become a text once it was written down? Is spoken language a text? Is, for example, a prayer a text? In the sense, a prayer that you may, I don't know, spontaneously create if you do this? Or if you go to church and say the Lord's Prayer, then perhaps the Lord's Prayer might be more of a text because it's always the same, while another prayer might be much more spontaneously created. I don't know. I don't really have answers to this either. There are very clear text types in here, or clear instances of texts, like a literary document. But we really need to know, or we need to define, or we need to think about what a text is in order to see whether all these others actually fit too. Okay. Now, let's look at this from a more linguistic point of view. Perhaps some people know what text actually means. It comes from texere, which means to weave. Okay. So that's basically what a text is. A text is something, well, it's a metaphor. It's something that is woven, that is put together in possibly rather an intricate pattern. What is woven together? Well, something, well, like different sentences. Okay. And how is this done? Well, that's exactly what we're going to do, or to look at for the next maybe 60 minutes or so. I expect this lecture to be over a little bit early again. I'd like to... That's where the clapping usually starts, isn't it? No? No, okay. Yeah, thank you. No, okay. I'd like to, since we're in the mood, show you a little extract of a video that makes a point that I would like to elaborate on a little bit. Many of you will know this. I'll put this down for a moment. Okay, end of entertainment. Here's the transcript for those of you who couldn't understand every word, or follow every word, I guess. What's special about this? You've got Yoda saying things in a way that is a little bit unusual, right? Sick have I become. That's not how we would usually put it. I've become sick. Yeah. Look, I so old to young eyes. Okay. What's odd here? That's odd in a different way. Okay. What we would usually say nowadays is, do I look so old? But that's just basically because something is missing that we nowadays need to form questions. But with the sick have I become, it's not that something is missing, it's that something has been rearranged in the order and the sequence of words. Sick have I become. When 900 years old you reach, look as good you will not. Okay. So Yoda seems to have some trouble with putting words in the right order, at least when we look at standard present-day English. Okay. Now, can you say sick have I become when you're not Yoda? Is that something that might be said? Sick have I become? Yeah, okay. Is that something like you wanted to say that too?
Well, I wanted to say the context is what when I know the Star Wars convention, then yeah, you would say something like.
Okay, you might actually be mocking, or you might be doing a Yoda. Yes, okay. No, but that's not what I meant. I meant, are there actually contexts in everyday conversation, in normal standard English, where you might also reorder certain elements in the sentence? Now, we'll look at some of those, and in fact, many of them are not actually very unusual. They just need the right context, or they need to be in the right place in the text. Okay. Now, obviously, there is something odd here about Yoda, and that's the whole idea. I mean, not about Yoda, but about the language. Possibly about Yoda as well. But anyway. Okay, when we look at things like that, we're in the area of text linguistics. Now let's look at a few things that make up a text. Last time, I talked about reference, about different types of reference when we were in the field of semantics. Okay. Now, I think I already briefly mentioned a sentence, or in fact a sequence of sentences like this. The man ordered a sandwich, it came after 10 minutes. If we've got a sandwich, then this is a referring expression. It's introduced in an indefinite noun phrase. And then in the second sentence, it is taken up again. It is referred to again. We have another referring expression, but this time, the referring expression is no longer a noun phrase consisting of a noun, but it's a noun phrase basically consisting of a pronoun. It's the same referent. So we talk about co-reference in cases like this. Two elements in two different sentences have the same referent, and they are referred to, in this case, via two different referring expressions. Now, there are different ways of referring to the same thing in different parts of the text. This is a term that you will need to learn because it's a frequent term, or it's a common way of referring. This is a case of anaphoric reference. Okay. The word refers back towards or to something that has been introduced before. In fact, this can also happen within a sentence. Okay. President Obama told Oprah Winfrey on Sunday night he gives himself a good solid B+ for his first 11 months in the Oval Office. That sentence was added a while ago. Okay. Or, if we've got something like this, small amounts of heroin, which Kedi, said he had been given by a friend, were also found. In both of these sentences, we again have a pronoun, or pronouns, that refer to some entity that has been introduced before. We've got he, and himself, and his, all three referring to who? Well, presumably to President Obama. But theoretically, given the right context, of course it could refer to another person. Okay. Obama has just met with, I don't know, Sarkozy, and he reports what he'd been told by him. Okay. And then suddenly, it becomes perhaps a reference to someone else. This is very unlikely, because the Oval Office obviously places this in the right context of American politics. So it's not actually the pronoun itself which makes the core reference 100% clear, but in fact something else in the text. Some additional information, in fact information that we need to know in order to be 100% sure. If we don't know that the White House has an Oval Office, then you could still, theoretically, refer to another person here. This is perhaps a little bit more obvious here. Small amount of heroin which Katie said he had been given by a friend. Without knowing more of the context, he could be either Keddie, or however you pronounce his name, or someone else that he refers to. So there may actually be certain cases of ambiguity. However, this is rather rare. Okay? Usually ambiguity doesn't arise in circumstances like that. But there could be. But these are cases of, and that's the main reason why I wanted to give them to you, intrasentential coreference, inside one sentence. Perhaps the more common one is suprasentential. Supra basically just meaning crossing the borders or the boundaries of a single sentence. Americans are much better at this than we are. They inquire more. They are not content to just rest on their laurels. Okay? Laurels. This, in that sense, links two or more sentences. And what is actually the linking or the glue or the weaving strategy is the fact that the same referent is taken up with a different linguistic element in a second sentence. So it's a marker, it's something that we see, it's something that is overt, something that is visible in the sentence which links the two sentences together. And that's why the metaphor is there for text. Now I said anaphoric reference is the standard way of coreference. There is also something, and this I don't expect you to learn and actively apply. There is also the opposite, which is cataphoric reference, which, well, if it's the opposite, then it's probably a reference forward rather than backward. So we have a situation where something is first referred to with a pronoun and then introduced as a full noun phrase. Here he comes, our mayor, the gangly bono of Kansas City. Okay? So we pretend that, or we assume that this is possible, that the referent is retrievable, or, yeah, it's almost like a stylistic tool, right? You might find something like that at the beginning of a literary, well, a novel or something like that. This is, in fact, a beginning of a newspaper article, the first line. But it's marked. It's not the norm. It's usually the other way around, that you first introduce the referent and then you refer to it with a pronoun. Notice, by the way, that, of course, our mayor has the same reference as well. Okay, that was anaphoric reference, which is important. Cataphoric reference, which is less frequent and less important. There is also something that's called exophoric reference, exo meaning outside, is something that refers to something that's not actually in the text, but it may actually be basically in the context of the situation where the text is produced. Look at that. Okay. So I'm actually pointing to something not towards what I've said, which would be inside the text, but I'm pointing to something that is just in the situation where I produce the text. This is a case of deixis. We're pointing towards something. Okay? If you want to read up on that, Finnegan has more on the concept of deixis. Notice it's deixis and not deixis, as most people or many people at some stage produce. Okay. But as I said, the most important concept is anaphoric reference. Okay, I said that we are really in the area of text linguistics when we're looking at how texts are woven together. Here is a quick definition of text linguistics by Andreas Jucker, who is a professor of linguistics at Zurich University. Text linguistics investigates the regularities of language beyond the boundaries of individual sentences. Okay? Regularities, it's something that happens again and again and again. It's typical of what makes a text. It categorizes, and that's the second thing, it categorizes text into different types or genres on the basis of their internal and external features and their function. And it analyzes their structure and other linguistic properties. Now, most of the rest of the lecture is going to be about the first part, the regularities of language beyond the boundaries of individual sentences in the sense of how they are put together. The final few slides will be on text types and genres and what makes, let's say, a newspaper or a letter text typical of that. Okay, let's have a closer look at how these links that I've now introduced, I introduced one type, can be realized linguistically. A man walked into a bar. Bars sell good beer. It's mainly brewed in Germany. Germany went to war with Britain in whatever. Okay. Do we have any links here? Think about it for a moment. And then look at this one. This store contained a row of wooden cages. The man bought a dog. The child wanted the animal. The father drove home. If you compare the two texts, okay, the two short extracts, which of the two texts has overt markers of things belonging together? The first one, yes. Bar, in fact, we've got a repetition of the word bar, okay, beer, good beer, and then good beer is taken up again with it, etc. Is there anything wrong with the first text? Yes, I think you can quite clearly see that this is odd. A man walked into a bar. Bars sell good beer. Okay, we sell something about... Hear something general about beer, or in fact about bars. And then there is really no connection between beer and it's brewed in Germany. Okay, we have beer that's been brewed in Germany, but still. And then that they went to war. But we have something that sticks together nevertheless. Whether it makes sense or not, let's leave that for the moment. Does the second part, the second extract, have any overt markers? No. Does it make sense? Can you understand what's going on? Well, I think many of you will be quite happy to come up with a story that fits quite nicely. The store contained a row of wooden cages. It's probably a pet shop, right? The man bought a dog, and the dog is probably a dog that was in one of the small cages. We don't know, really, from looking at the text. The child wanted the animal. We probably expect the child to be the son of the man, right? Or the daughter of the man. The father drove home. Okay, now we know that it's actually the father, but we also, in fact, even at an earlier stage, think that there must be a connection. But there are no overt markers in the sense that we have, for example, a pronoun. Okay. Before I go on with this, I'd like to change something, just a little bit. A store contained a row of wooden cages. A man bought a dog. A child wanted an animal. A father drove home. Okay. Do you agree that it's now much more difficult to make a story out of this. And that's because in the second case, in the second variant, we have indefinite reference. And this means that basically it is becoming more difficult. There is no referent in that sense which is introduced to readers that can be taken up, that can be said to exist in our imagination. Okay. So in other words, grammatical forms seem to influence our ability to make a story out of a text. Whether definite or indefinite references used seems to be important for whether sentences stick together or not. Okay, here's another, basically an example of something that we've had before. This is a long time ago. Many of you may not remember this. Some of you will. Mr. Clinton, ex-president of the United States, as I'm sure you know, finally admitted that he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky. The president did his best to avoid embarrassing questions. Can we be sure that Mr. Clinton and the president are co-referential? Well, we know about this from outside, well, from non-linguistic or extra-linguistic knowledge, but it's not really done linguistically entirely. We need to know that Mr. Clinton was president of the United States at some stage in order to fully make that link with 100% certainty. Because once it is used, once it is a name, Mr. Clinton, and once it is the president, which is the name of an office or the name of a person holding an office. So in this case, it's actually additional information, again, a little bit of that, which we need in order to make it 100% clear what the connection is. There is, of course, the option of repeating the words. That's the most, the most wordy, okay, and the most unambiguous way of co-referring. The Prime Minister recorded her thanks to the Foreign Secretary. The Prime Minister was most eloquent. Okay, admittedly, it could still be two different Prime Ministers, but that's very unlikely. So this is one way of establishing a link. It's the full repeated form. Sometimes we might partially repeat it. Dr. E.C.R. Reeve chaired the meeting. Dr. Reeve invited, etc. Here we have a case of a noun phrase being referred to again with a noun phrase, but the noun phrase is different. It's similar to Mr. Clinton and the president. Roe's daughter is ill again. The child is hardly ever well. What's this? This is a case of lexical replacement. It's not full repetition, but we're replacing the noun phrase with another noun phrase. Here we have the standard way of doing it. This is the most frequent one, I would think. Rose said she would have to take Sophie to the doctor. Okay. That's the one that I introduced with the sandwich and it before. In fact, we can also substitute other things than a pronoun. Here we have the word one. Jules has a birthday next month. Elspeth has 1, 2. And in fact, we could even have something like this. Jules has a birthday next month. Elspeth has 2. Okay. Where there is something there that isn't there. Okay, it's an elided form. It's a zero, so to speak. So there are many different ways of establishing co-reference, And I'd like to give you a 2-3 minute, not break really, but a breather, as I sometimes do, quite early in the lecture this time. And I would like you to look for all the links that you find in this brief text. And I'll give you 2 minutes for that. So find elements that are co-referential or that establish some sort of link. Okay, let's see what you have. Any obvious links? Anyone? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes, okay. Yes, exactly. So Lord Melbourne, who's taken up again in the relative clause. Now, I've actually also highlighted Prime Minister here because it's got the same reference, or it refers to, it says more about Lord Melbourne. This is not a case of anaphoric reference with a pronoun, okay? But yes, you're absolutely right with the he here and the he further on. Okay? So that is clearly something that links the sentences together. Okay? Anything else? Who's them and they? Sorry? Oh, the rooks, yes. Okay. Yes? I've got Queen Victoria first here, but yes. Okay, so that basically gives it away. We've got Victoria, who became queen. Again, this is slightly different from the repetition that we have here and she, which are straightforward, co-referential cases of, in fact, here, anaphoric reference. Yeah? But yes, you're absolutely right. Rooks and them and they and there. Okay? Anything else? Now, the others are actually... Mm-hmm.
Is there maybe a united form that's different, like Birdsong and Birdsong distinguished because it refers to Lord Melbourne? He
did not like Birdsong. Yes. You have a coordination there where the subject is not repeated. Yes. Okay. Yes. Good. Good. I hadn't put this in there. Yes. You could, in a way, say that. Well, either we have a coordinated verb phrase inside the verb phrase, or we have two clauses that are coordinated. Yes. Good. Okay. Now we have other elements which link this text together. But they are more sort of lexical. They're more lexical collocations or words from the same lexical field. So things that have to do with birds and their singing. Okay? Or in fact here, bird song, singing, calling, etc. Now this is not exactly the same, this is not anaphoric reference, but this also adds to the texthood. In fact, even words like anyway or best of all add to linking things together because, well, anyway, what is this? This is a marker that shows some kind of attitude towards what was said before. Okay. So, in other words, this set of sentences is full of overt indications that certain, well, that the individual's parts belong together. And importantly, they are overt. We can see them, we can find them, we can color them. Okay, I'll give you two terms that are handy in this connection, that are important. The first one is cohesion. And here's a brief definition. Cohesion is a semantic, syntactic concept manifested by overt, so visible, grammatical and lexical signs or ties in the text. So, if we have a text like the one that we've just seen before, and there are so many elements that link sentences with each other, then we can say that there are a lot of cohesive ties that tie together the individual sentences, or that weave together the individual sentences to a text. Now we've seen that cohesion alone, or cohesive elements, do not necessarily make a text. Remember, a man walked into the bar sell good beer, it's mainly brewed in Germany, etc. There are lots of cohesive ties, but we say that it doesn't really make sense. Yeah? So, cohesive ties alone, or these overt links, are not sufficient, are not enough to make a text into something that is coherent. Yeah? And that brings me to the second term, coherence. Coherence has nothing to do with something that you immediately see, so nothing that is overt, nothing that is a lexical item in the text like he or it or something like that. Coherence is a semantic, pragmatic concept which contributes to the communicative unity of a text. This is quite theoretical, I guess. But anyway, if we experience a text being a complete whole, the text is coherent, with or without textual manifestations. So, remember the text where the father with the boy came in and bought the dog? There were no prototypical cohesive markers, but we still experienced the set of sentences as a coherent text that we could make into a story in our minds. While with the other type, where we have anaphoric reference, etc., it's not really in our minds, it's overtly in the text that it's shown that they belong together. And this is because we sort of assume that it makes sense what people put together on paper, that there must be a connection. We will come back to concepts like this when we talk about pragmatics next week. We generally assume that when people communicate, that they want to make sense. And if it looks as if they didn't, we still assume that they want to make sense and therefore make sense of what doesn't make sense. Okay? Sorry, that was a bit confusing, but next week you'll hear much more of that. So yes, it's the assumption that these utterances belong together, so let's make sense of them, even though on the surface they don't look as if they make sense at all. Okay, so I've introduced coreference, I've introduced particularly anaphoric coreference, and I've marked, or I've told you that they are elements of cohesion, but there is also something else which is much more, I don't know, much more interpretative, or whatever you want to call it, and that's called coherence. A very small aside, just because I think that's quite interesting. Have a look at this. Wash and core 6 cooking apples. Put them into a fireproof dish. Is the reference of them exactly the same as 6 cooking apples? Well, in a way, yes, but in a different way. Of course, they have changed shape and lost some of their properties. Once they're in the fireproof dish, they don't have the seeds anymore and their cores are gone. Okay. But we still seem to be able to refer to them with the same type of pronoun. Okay. So the state has changed. That's just a little aside to show that there is, again, as always, more things than just the basics that one can consider. We have no problems dealing with that, but how exactly our brain does that is perhaps quite interesting. Another aside. The judge said that the sacking of Mr. Poes was unlawful. Yesterday he said that he was pleased. You might remember that sentence. Okay. Who is referred to by he? We have two options. The judge or Mr. Poes? Well, compare it to this one. The judge said the sacking of Mr. Poes was unlawful. Yesterday he said he had changed his mind. Now, in both cases, theoretically, the anaphoric reference with he could refer to either of the reference introduced, the judge or Mr. Poes. But one is more likely than the other. Yeah? So, what exactly makes this more likely is an interesting question to which I can't give an answer right now because that would take us too far. Can I have one more little aside? You may see this in a bus in Britain. Stop bus vandals by reporting it at once to the driver or conductor. Do we have any element of anaphoric reference here? Yes, of course. We've got it. What is it? It's not bus vandals. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be the thing that they do, right? So in a way it doesn't quite make sense, but still we can make perfect sense of this. Remember that in order to establish reference, sometimes we need to have certain knowledge. Okay. Like, for example, that when we refer to the sun, that we refer to the sun in our planetary system. Okay. That corner is very loud up there. Okay. So, we can see that, in a way, two things interact here, both cohesion and coherence. We know that bus vandalism results in something, okay, and that something should be stopped. Okay. And that's, in a way, a case of coherence, but we are using cohesive markers to create that link, too. Okay, end of asides. I don't want to complicate matters too much. Somehow I hear the same person still chatting. Would that person please stop chatting? Okay, one important concept as well when we talk about text is whether information that is referred to is new or given. New in the sense that it hasn't been introduced before, or given in the sense that we already have a referent that was established by way of a referring expression. Who ate the pizza? Well, Aaron ate the pizza. Aaron is new information. Well, yeah. Otherwise, Alice wouldn't have asked. Okay. And the pizza is old information in the response. In fact, it would probably be more natural to replace it with it. Oh, Aaron ate it. Sorry, probably I should have, I should have removed the question mark here. Aaron ate the pizza. Yeah. That is not the question mark. Yes?
Would the act of eating the pizza also be old information?
Would the act of eating the pizza be old information?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good question because
Aaron did.
Aaron did, yes. Yes. I see what you mean. And when we talk about old and new information, we typically talk about elements that are introduced that have a reference, usually, of sort. And that is different because it's a verbal action that you're referring to. But yes, you're absolutely right. You could, in a way, say that this is something similar because you can replace it with did. Okay? So Aaron did. Yes, you're right. It's a similar phenomenon. It's not typically the same thing. Okay? Yes, but good question. In fact, you may have noticed that pronouns are, of course, much shorter than the words or the noun phrases that they replace, and this is very typical. Okay? And you can even link this up perhaps to our cognitive abilities. You only need a very short word like it or he or they to refer to something that is very present in our minds, but if we need to introduce a referent, then we may need many more words. Okay? So the shorter coreference element is, perhaps the more likely it is in our short-term memory that we can retrieve it from. Okay, Ken finally returned my car last night. The gas tank was nearly empty. This is a kind of sequence of sentences that might have been part of the semantics lecture as well. Because the point that I made there was that some referents are introduced or can be introduced as definite reference because we have extra linguistic knowledge that cars have gas tanks. Okay. So I can refer to this. In that sense, in this sequence of sentences, the gas tank is given because of our extra linguistic knowledge. Now, why am I telling you about given and new information? Because the way you order things within a sentence may actually be an indication about whether an element in the sentence, whether a referring expression refers to something that is given or new. And we are back with Yoda. Okay. I heard that you really like mushrooms. Mushrooms I'd kill for. Yeah? This sounds pretty much like Yoda. Now, different, of course, because here it is in a context where I'm reintroducing given information. This is very similar to left dislocation. Okay, another fancy term. Holly, I can't stand her. What's different? Well, Holly, I can't stand, would be fronting, where if you look at the syntactic structure, there is now basically an empty slot from which Holly has been fronted. While with mushroom, with Holly, I can't stand her, we've got a repetition of the referent. Okay. This is also usually used to reintroduce given information. Okay. So in other words, by using a particular structure, we signpost, we indicate, this is given information. Here's another structure, the so-called it cleft. It was Nick that Stan saw at the party. That perhaps out of context sounds a little bit odd. I'll give you a context in a minute. There are it clefts and there are WH clefts. WH because it starts with a word that is a WH word. So who or what or where. Who Stan saw at the party was Nick. Okay. In both cases, Nick is what? Old or new information? I think you can agree that it's new information. Okay. Notice that in the it cleft, it is in a different part of the sentence, of the syntactic structure. Just if you think that these sound rather unnatural, let's see whether that helps. Alice told me that Stan saw someone at the party that he knew from his school days. It turns out it was Nick that Stan saw at the party. Okay. Sounds okay? And Nick is newly introduced as a referent in an it cleft. And the sentence on its own is slightly odd, and that's what Yoda sounds like. Okay. But if you put it together in a sequence of sentences and thereby create a text, then it may make perfect sense. Oh yes, another point that I wanted to make in this context. Let's have a look at this short, well, perhaps the beginning of a text. Bill Sutcliffe walked into the restaurant and called over to the waitress. The atmosphere was hot and sticky. Who do you think felt that the atmosphere was hot and sticky? Is it Bill Sutcliffe? Or is it the waitress? Do you agree that it's likely that it's Bill Sutcliffe who feels that it's... I see some heads nodding. Why? Well, let's look at this. The waitress saw Bill Sutcliffe walk into the restaurant and calling over to her. The atmosphere was hot and sticky. I think it's now the waitress who feels that the atmosphere is hot and sticky. Why is that? Well, because the first text seems to be about Bill Sutcliffe and what he experiences, and Bill Sutcliffe is in what position, in what syntactic function? Well, in the subject. Bill Sutcliffe walked into the restaurant. But if it's the waitress who is in the subject, then the situation is different, because now the text is more likely about the waitress. So there seems to be a connection between syntactic function and what a text is about, or what the topic of a text is. Here's a quote from Finnegan, the 2008 version. The topic of a sentence is its center of attention. What the sentence is about, its point of departure. Now, in fact, I don't like that definition. I think it's not helpful. I think you cannot talk about the topic of a sentence. But you can talk about the topic of a text, because it's something that is referred to again and again, and typically in subject position. Now I'd like to give you another breather. And I'd like to, or I'd like you to read a text. In fact, shall I read it out? I'll read it out. Finding the right lotions to keep the skin smooth is not all that is involved in maintaining youth and beauty. Larger social conditions inevitably affect one's concern with beauty. Personal investment or natural aesthetics have little to do with the maintenance of beauty. Rather, people's anxiety about social belonging are fed off by the powerful commercial imperative that drives them. The desire to maximize their corporate profit causes the beauty enterprises and multinationals to influence personal lives invisibly but effectively in this manner. Are you still following me? Difficult, right? Needs are stimulated in the first place by the beauty industry to which customers of beauty products respond. Such effects hurt women in particular, not least because they are the direct target of beauty advertising. Advertisements for cosmetics notoriously make them feel inadequate, and the money spent on advertised products is a result of this feeling. I think you probably have had some trouble following me. Let's think about what this text is about. Can it be improved? If yes, how? And why is this improvement better? I'll give you 2-3 minutes to think about that. Think about things like core reference and topic and given it new information, etc., etc. This is, by the way, an exercise that you could use for your own essay writing. Okay. Now, obviously, this is difficult without you having the text in front of you in a format that you can reformulate things. But if you think about what this text is about and where the elements that are talked about in the text are placed syntactically, then I think you'll find that this text is badly organized. Each and every sentence is perfectly okay, but the way they are woven together is problematic. Rather than asking you, I don't think we have the time for that, what solutions you have, I'd like to give you the solution that I have. Maintaining youth and beauty is more than just a question of finding the right lotions to keep the skin smooth. Inevitably, one's concern with beauty is caught up in larger social conditions. The maintenance of beauty has little to do with personal investment or natural aesthetics. Rather, people are driven by a powerful commercial imperative designed to feed off their anxieties about social belonging. In this manner, etc., etc. I don't have to read the whole text now. What's happened? Well, what's the topic here? I've coloured this. I've now put, well, it wasn't me, but what we've got here is a text where now maintaining youth and beauty, concern with beauty, the maintenance of beauty, the people who do this, okay, and then later beauty is taken up again, is now placed in more likely positions in the sentence for, well, they have there is more aboutness now in that sense. Okay, this is now a text about beauty and the maintenance of beauty, and then we move over to people, the customers, women, and they. And suddenly, the text is more coherent. We probably haven't greatly increased the markers of cohesion, but it's now simply by reordering elements in the sentence become a much more text-like text. Yeah? A much more coherent text. Alright? So, and I think that also makes the point that a topic is a topic when it is repeatedly mentioned, or when it is repeatedly the center of attention. So in a way we could talk about a topic chain. Something is introduced, then referred to again, perhaps slightly differently, or it's within the same lexical field, and then we have a topic. So I don't like the concept of a topic of a sentence. Some people would disagree. Okay, before I talk about texts and genres for a few minutes, I would like to give you a brief outlook towards what's going to come in the next two lectures. There's the doorbell. I'm in the bath. Can you make sense of this? I think you can. Yeah. What's the situation? Well, let's say, I don't know, husband and wife, let's make a story. He's downstairs in the living room, she's upstairs in the bath, having a bath, wet and naked. Okay? Unlikely to open the door when the doorbell rings in that state. Okay? What does A want? A wants B to open the door. B says, no, I can't because I'm in the bath. But does it actually say that here? No, we all make that up. We make a story. Not because of cohesive ties, but because that's the only way to make sense. Well, there may be different ways, but this is one very likely way of linking two elements that really seem to have nothing to do with each other. What does the statement, I'm in the bath, have to do with the fact that the doorbell has rung? Well, really only if we interpret this as a request. So, next time we're again going to talk about elements that link things together, but there we're really only talking about these sort of interpretative elements that create coherence rather than cohesion. Okay, a few final slides about texts in general and text types or genres and registers. In fact, this is a minefield, a terminological minefield. Linguists disagree about these terms. Some people prefer register, which some linguists define by internal criteria. What words are used, what constructions are used, what grammatical forms. And these linguists would then use the word genre more for external features, like what it is what it is created for. A letter, for example, or a linguistics textbook has another purpose, okay, or a recipe. Some people then use text type as an umbrella term. Okay, but as I said, you'll find lots of disagreement in the literature. But that's not so important in the present context. What I'd like to show you is that different text types, let's use the generic term, can be distinguished by some features, some of which have to do with the kind of things I've introduced before today. If I look at your assignments, I might say this, well, I didn't. Okay. I think I'm going mad. Didn't I tell you to do this for your assignment? Yes, I did. I really mean it when I say things like that. Okay. If I said this to you, which is unlikely, then you would probably agree with me that this is a highly interactive way of communicating. There isn't all that much information in there, apart from the fact that I'm unhappy. Look at this one instead. A depressing spectacle was encountered. An entire class of scholars might have been expected to excel in their chosen fields, but no one took the trouble to carry out the exercises requested. Very critical. Just as critical in some ways, like telling someone off for not doing what they should have done. But it is much more informative in some way and much less interactive. And it contains different linguistic structures. For example, was encountered. What is this? It's a passive. There was no passive in the first text. Now, the person who's looked at this in much detail, and much more detail than I can mention here, is Doug Biber, who wrote a famous book called Variation Across Speech and Writing. Now, you'll hear a lot more about variation next semester, but I'd like to look at one or two things that he's done with you. What he's done is actually quite mathematical, or he's using statistical methods to compare texts. Okay. He's looking at things that cluster together. What kind of things? Well, for example, he's found out that in order to for a text to feel or to be involved, it will have a lot of private verbs. Think, believe, and things like that. It'll have contractions. It'll probably, I mean, it doesn't mean that it has to have, but it'll probably have present tense verbs. It'll have second person pronouns, demonstrative pronouns. Emphatics that I could have mentioned right now. And first person pronouns like I and me. And adjectives after copula B. This list could go on. Now, these are all structural elements of texts, grammatical elements of texts. You are unlikely to find lots of nouns. You're unlikely to find very long words. You're unlikely to find prepositional phrases. And you're unlikely to find pre-modifying adjectives. Now, you might find the odd one, but not a lot of them. And the same thing, and I'm not going through that list in any great detail now, can be done for narrative versus non-narrative. Can I please have a bit more silence up there? Please don't annoy me at the beginning of the year. What is this? This is the university. You're not school children. Even those shouldn't, but anyway. So, we've got positive features that signal narrative texts. And then we might actually have, well, again, the opposite. Again, as I said, we don't need to look at this in great detail. But the point that I want to make, that if you look at this, and you look at lots of texts, what you can then make out of this is something like a two-dimensional scale or a two-dimensional graph where you can place different text types on the basis of their internal criteria. So, for example, you will find that official documents are much more non-narrative. Makes sense. But they are more informational than they're involved. While conversation might also be rather non-narrative, more non-narrative than personal letters, but the difference is that personal letters and conversation are much more involved. So it's a way of placing different text types on a plane purely on the basis of internal criteria. This is also something that has to do with text linguistics. If we look at the definition of Euchre that I gave you at the beginning, but I'm more interested in you knowing and being able to apply things like given a new or types of reference like anaphoric reference, etc., in order to show how a text is woven together. But I wanted to mention that anyway very briefly. Next week we're going to look at pragmatics, and it's the first of two lectures. In fact, the lecture is called How to Do Things with Words, if I remember correctly. Okay. Well, the emphasis is on how to do things with words, how to act with words. And just to give you an example, what we see here is Calvin hammering, as a child would do, nails into the coffee table. And the mother is coming into the room and shouts, as mothers would do in this situation, "Calvin, what are you doing to the coffee table?" Calvin is a bit surprised and says, "Is this some sort of trick question or what?" Now, the question obviously, and this is not really a question, I guess, is what is she actually saying by what are you doing to the coffee table? She's not asking an information question, but she's obviously asking Calvin to stop. Okay. But he takes it very literally. He takes it to be an information question. Why, under normal circumstances, we interpret this not to be a question for information, but a request or a command to stop, is what we're going to talk about next week. Okay. So, see you next Friday.